Anyone have any questions? The question is, what are the resources that demonstrate that there was writing 2,000 years before Moses? Well, in archaeological excavations that have been done in the country that we know today as Iraq, they have found libraries, royal libraries, that are written in what is known as cuneiform. Cuneiform was the style of writing that was used at least as early as 3200 BC. Based on the various ways that archaeology is able to date things, these are what are known as clay tablets. If you take a piece of clay, when it's soft, you can impress on it certain drawings or certain figures or something like that. And then you can put it in a fire, and if you have a high enough fire, it will make it what we call ceramic. And ceramic lasts forever. I have a piece of a pot that I picked up at what at one time was thought to be the site of Ai that was dated to 3000 BC. Now, this piece of the pot did not have any kind of writing or anything. It was just up on the shoulder part here where the big part of the pot narrowed down, and it was just laying on the ground. And it was not of any special archaeological significance, but it was a real nice souvenir. And I asked one of my professors over in Israel when I was studying there about it, and he looked at it very carefully, and he said, it's probably about 3000 BC, which 3000 BC, Moses, depending on how you want to time it, he lived somewhere between 1400 and 1200 BC. Probably closer to the 1400 than the 1200. Cuneiform writing goes back approximately 2,000 years before Moses. If you go to Egypt today, all over Egypt, you will find inscriptions written in the ancient the ancient form of writing, hieroglyphs. And by being able to date the remains in the various temples and tombs that are found, they date these things to oftentimes the Old Kingdom, the Middle Kingdom, or the Late Kingdom. Moses lived during this time period, and the Old Kingdom of Egypt dated back to around the year 3000 BC. And so writing began, as far as we know, in ancient Mesopotamia, what we call Iraq today, about 200 years before writing began to emerge in Egypt. And cuneiform was the standard form of writing until probably the development of the kind of writing that was in use in the New Testament period, which is similar to modern-day Hebrew. And so, as I said earlier, Moses, because he was of the royal family, probably not only could read, but also write in cuneiform and hieroglyphs. He might also have been able to read and write in, you can call it the Canaanite script or the Israelite script. I'm just going to say the Israelite script. That they have now found remains of this script that date at least as early as 1800 BC. Now, given the fact that this is the time period of Moses, in any one of these three, this would be the common one in Egypt. This was the international form of writing, and this was what was used in the area where Moses' family tradition was from. So we don't know how many of these Moses may have learned, but he probably was capable of reading and writing in at least one or two or all three different scripts. Some of you can read and write English and Estonian. Some of you can read and write English and Russian, or Estonian and Russian. It's not that difficult to shift from one to another form of writing. It involves some memorization, especially with the cuneiform and the hieroglyphs, because these were syllabic languages. But it's today been well demonstrated that Moses could have written in any one of these three scripts, and maybe others, as early as he might have been taught that in his childhood. And he almost certainly was taught these things in his childhood, since he was the child of a pharaoh. Okay, did I answer your question? Okay. Now, then let's take a look for a minute. We've talked about the background of biblical theology as a response to some fairly negative aspects of systematic theology. And then we've looked at the impact that different schools of thinking, especially the higher critical and the Religionsgeschichte schools of thinking, had on biblical theology to more or less bring it down to a level where some people questioned whether there even was any value to biblical theology. But as increasingly things have become known about the ancient world and archaeology and things like that, there has been a, you might say, kind of a revision back to the possibility that, in fact, biblical theology may actually contribute significantly to an understanding of the faith that we share. And so one of the things that is important to see is the Christian approach, the Christian approach right there, and the Jewish approach to understanding the Old Testament. And as I said before, one of the problems in most Christian efforts to understand the Old Testament is that most scholars in the Christian world attempt to go back and look at the Old Testament from a Christian perspective. So, for instance, in the the second chapter of Genesis, you read God says, "Let us make man in our own image." And so immediately, Christian authors and Christian theologians who are conservative enough to do this say, ah, there's evidence of the Trinity right there. Well, maybe. Maybe not. But you see, for the Christian thinking of it through the framework of New Testament scholarship and New Testament understanding, that is evidence of the Trinity. Well, okay, maybe, but not necessarily. And it goes on this way through a lot of other things. If you've ever heard of the concept of dispensationalism. Dispensationalism is a fairly well-known, very conservative teaching that God dealt with man in different ways at different times. And each of these time periods is a dispensation. So God dealt with man in a particular way until Moses. Then after Moses and the law came, then God dealt with man on the basis of the law. And that continued until Jesus came. Then God dealt with man through Jesus. And then after Jesus' death and resurrection and the coming of the Holy Spirit, God dealt with man in a yet a different way via the Holy Spirit. And then there'll be the millennium, and God will deal with man differently then. And then, of course, the final judgment and eternity, and God will deal again with man differently then, and so on. All of this is a way in which Christians, none of this is shared by the Jewish world, but this is the way Christians have taken pieces and ideas and read them into the Old Testament from a Christian sense in order to understand certain things as they see them in the Old Testament. Well, this is a problem because the Old Testament is something that was written by Israelites for Israelites at the time when the Israelite people were very, very alive and active. And so it's important to not simply read into the Old Testament New Testament concepts, but to let the Old Testament speak for itself. Now, you might say, okay, what about the Jews then? The Jews interpret from within the Old Testament, but though they would not like me to say it, especially the rabbis, they do not actually simply let the Old Testament speak for itself. But in the Jewish approach, what happens is that the Jewish world is based essentially on rabbinical thought. And so actually the foundation of Jewish understanding today is not the Old Testament, but the Talmud. Have you ever heard the term Talmud? Yes? Okay. So the Talmud is this huge multi-volume, it's about that many volumes or more, something like 18 volumes of commentary on the Old Testament. Very often what will happen in the Talmud is you'll have a page like this, and you'll have right here one verse from the Old Testament. And you'll have commentary by various teachers, various rabbis, all over the page, telling you what various rabbis literally over the last 1,500 to 1,800 years have said about this verse. Sometimes it's more than one verse, sometimes it's just one verse. And so in the Jewish understanding of the Old Testament, it is based literally on what this rabbi said, and then what this rabbi said about what this rabbi said about the verse, and then what this rabbi said about what this one said about what this one said about the verse, and so on. Remember in the Gospels that Jesus talks about, or at least the Gospels talk about the fact that Jesus spoke as one having authority, and not as the teachers of his day? Well, in his day, they were doing exactly the same thing. There were senior rabbis who would speak about some particular aspect of the faith being based on the Old Testament because there was no New Testament yet. And the rabbi would say something which was based on what this rabbi said, which was based on what this rabbi said, and so on going back for some period of time. And when they would teach not of their own authority, but rather they would teach based on the authority of earlier rabbis. No matter how high they were in respect among the rabbis, they were always appealing to an earlier rabbi as the source of their authority. What made Jesus' teaching different was he didn't quote a lot of rabbis and a lot of authority. He simply said, "This is how it is." And the people loved it, because listening to him teach, they could experience the reality of God and not this authority said this, who said this, who said this, who said this, and so on like that. So the people loved hearing it. And this, of course, was the traditional approach of the Jewish world and remains the approach to this day, with the rabbi saying what this one said, which says what this one said, which says what this one said, and so on. So today, the Jewish faith is influenced by things like particular symbols and festivals and traditional teachings of the rabbis. And so a Jewish person, if they are honest with you, will tell you, the basis of our faith is not, meaning the Jewish faith, is not the Old Testament. It's the Talmud. Jewish scholars, if they are honest with you, will tell you the basis of Jewish faith today is not the Old Testament. It is the Talmud. The Old Testament is kind of like a traditional book that just gets set off to the side, but the actual active basis of the faith is the Talmud, the teachings of the rabbis. And so while the idea is to let the interpretation come from within the Old Testament text, what really is happening is that it's the interpretation of one rabbi regarding an Old Testament text, and then the interpretation of another rabbi regarding what that first rabbi said about the Old Testament text, and so on like that. So, to give you an example, during Jesus' lifetime, there were lots of questions about what the law would allow. And one of the interesting things that does get referred to in the Gospels is that under the Old Testament law, if a man's ox fell in a ditch or a hole, that even on the day of the Sabbath, it was permitted for the man to go and to violate the law of the Sabbath to rescue the ox, because the ox was needed for plowing, which was necessary for food, which was necessary to sustain human life in order for people to walk with God. And so, because the ox was necessary for human life, it was okay to violate the law of the Sabbath to be able to rescue that ox. On the other hand, if your son or daughter got caught in that very same ditch, you had to wait until after the Sabbath was over to go rescue your son or daughter. Why? Because they'd be okay, maybe not comfortable, maybe not happy, maybe they'd have mosquito bites, but they'd be okay until the next day when you could pull them out. But the ox was a different story. This is the kind of interpretation we're talking about. And so in the Jewish world, the way in which interpretation occurred, even though it seems like it comes from within the Old Testament, it comes from rabbinical interpretation. Today, a truly observant Jew will not light a fire on a gas stove or start a car or turn a light switch on the Sabbath day, because the Old Testament says you will not kindle a fire on the Sabbath. Now, kindling a fire in Old Testament times was work. That's why you couldn't do it on the Sabbath. But you had to strike stones, or you had to somehow use something that would focus the sun's energy to start a fire or something like that. It was really work. You had to gather the what's called the tinder, the small stuff that would burn, and then a little bit larger stuff and a little bit larger stuff until you would be able to have a real fire. And it might take an hour or so to actually start a fire. So it was work. Today, flipping a light switch on is not work, but it is starting a fire. If we were to turn the lights totally off and it's 100% dark and you flip that switch, just like that, you'd see a spark. It still is starting a fire, but there's no work to it. But the rabbis have ruled that it's still starting a fire, and therefore it's not permitted. The same thing with a car, the same thing with a gas stove, and so on. When I lived in Israel, the stoves had four burners, and then they had what was called a Shabbat or Sabbath burner. And the Sabbath burner was lit at the evening before the Sabbath began, and it burned all night. and all the next day until the Sabbath was over. So if you wanted hot coffee, you could have it, as long as your Sabbath burner was working. But if the Sabbath burner went off, forget it. All you could have was cold food until the Sabbath was ended. Why? Because starting a fire on a stove is nothing more than scratching a match and putting it there. It's not work, but it's starting a fire. And the rabbis focused on starting a fire, not on the idea of what is work, in order to interpret that particular legal passage in the Old Testament. So, from the Jewish standpoint, yeah, you get interpretation from within the Old Testament, but not necessarily an interpretation that really has the kind of revelation that we're talking about in trying to understand what the Old Testament has to say. So, from the standpoint of both the Jewish and the Christian perspectives, a lot of times you have to be very careful about understanding and interpreting the Old Testament, not to read something into it. The Jewish read into it from the law and the teachings of the rabbis. The Christians read into it from the New Testament concept of faith, rather than letting the Old Testament speak for itself. Hopefully, in what we do in here, we're going to try to let the Old Testament speak to us, rather than reading into the Old Testament from the New Testament. So, what that means is, then, that first of all, if I make some preliminary comments, since we have a few minutes before the end of this session, one of the things that was common to not only the ancient Israelites, but actually to all of the ancient peoples, was the idea that their God was present in their midst. And this was the case for the Israelites. It was also the case for all of the other ancient peoples. They wanted to be able to see their God present in their midst. An interesting story, when the Roman general Titus destroyed Jerusalem in 70 AD, and before that he burned and destroyed the temple. He actually had intended for the temple not to be destroyed, but the soldiers were so zealous that they set fire to it, and he wanted to see what this God is that the Israelites worship. So he went into the temple and he yanked the curtain back, and he began to stumble back like this, and he said, in Latin of course, "The Jews worship nothing." Because you see, everybody else had their gods, physical idols, in their midst. The Jews didn't have that, but they had the symbol of the presence of God, which was the temple. And just like all of the ancient peoples, God for the Israelites was not an abstract thought. God was a real transcendent presence. Do you know the word transcendence? So God was a real, true, transcendent presence to them. And because he was truly there, then whatever they did and whatever they understood about God, it was based on the fact that he was literally there in their midst, symbolized by the, I'm going to use the term a number of times in here, the religious cultus. That means the temple and the laws and the traditions and the rituals associated with the temple. He was there through the religious cultus. He was there through the priests. He was there in the physical presence of the temple, symbolizing his presence in their midst. So for the Israelites and the Jews of New Testament time, God was not an abstract idea. He may have been unseen, if you compare it with the gods of the other peoples, but he was literally there in their midst, seen and represented by such things as the temple and the cultus, by the traditions of how he had saved and delivered the Israelite people, especially in the Exodus, but also in other times as well. The way he delivered Jerusalem from the hands of the Assyrians under Hezekiah, the way in which God brought the people through times of famine and drought. God was there in their midst through not only the prophets and the priests and the kings, but through the history of theophanies. Do you know what a theophany is? A theophany is the visible appearance of God in some manner to people. For instance, you see an early account of a theophany with Abraham. Abraham is in the city of Hebron. And it wasn't a city back then, but he was at Hebron. And there are these three visitors that come to him. And he says, wait, wait, don't go away. Let me kill the fatted calf and let's eat dinner. Okay, they do that. And then after they eat, then two of them go on down to Sodom. While the one, before going down to Sodom, actually lingers with Abraham, and it turns out that this is a visible, physical appearance of God to Abraham. Some people reading it from the New Testament will say, this is a pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus. As a Christian, I don't have a problem with that. But that is not what the Old Testament says. This is simply a visible, physical appearance of God to Abraham, what is called a theophany. Okay? There's angels that appear at various times, not just the one with Abraham there, but angels appeared, like for instance, late in the history, you have the angel that appears to Daniel and tells Daniel what is going to happen in the future. And if you've studied eschatology, you almost certainly have studied, I think it's Daniel 11, or Daniel 9, 10, and 11, something like that, related to the prophecies reported by Daniel, given to him by the angel, about the future of the world. Well, there was the tradition of these things that had been preserved for the people, verifying the idea that, in fact, God was present among the people. So one of the important things to keep in mind is that for the Israelites, God was not an abstraction. God was a very real presence. And that's where that word Emmanuel comes from, that I have up here. Well, I had it on the previous slide. Yeah. That's where the word Emmanuel comes from, right here. Because for the people of Israel, where the Old Testament came from, God was Emmanuel. And the Old Testament was a record of Emmanuel, God's presence and his actions and the reality of everything that was God for the people. And the essence of Emmanuel is the idea of God being right there in their midst. One of the things that is a significant part of approaching Old Testament study is how you view the Old Testament. So it's important for me, since I'm teaching this course, to let you know what I believe about the Old Testament. And what I believe about the Old Testament is that it is historical. Sometimes we may need to understand some context to understand what the history is, but that it is historical, that it can be dated. Abraham probably lived somewhere between 2000 and maybe 1800 BC, and that is Genesis 12, and that begins a dating process from that point on that can be followed all the way through the Old Testament. I believe that the Old Testament is honest in what it recounts, and the JEDP theory I do not accept at all. And actually, there have been, with computers, there have been some recent studies that are very interesting. I first heard of this when I was actually living in Israel doing graduate study. And one of the interesting things that they did was they did a linguistic analysis of the language of the Old Testament, not based on English, but based on Hebrew. And the conclusion of this computerized, computer-generated linguistic analysis was that, in fact, there is a high probability that one and only one person wrote the first five books of the Bible. Now, all of these other theories, they were not so much based on the Hebrew of the Old Testament. But this one was based on the Hebrew of the Old Testament using the same kinds of linguistic analysis that might be used for Shakespeare or something like that. And the determination of this computer-generated analysis was that there was a high degree, I think it was over 90% probability, that one and only one person wrote the entire first five books of the Bible. And so, quite separate from all of the JEDP, higher critical theories, and so on, there has been a very strong source suggesting that all of that was, in fact, written by one person. Now, was it Moses? Was it Joshua? Was it somebody at the time of the exile? That is not talked about in the analysis, only that those books were written by one person, which the books claim were written by Moses. So that's good enough for me, that it was from Moses. The other thing is to be aware that there has been, in the last 50 years, or 70 years maybe now, an increasingly large amount of discovery done dealing with every aspect of the Old Testament. And I think I mentioned it earlier that essentially all of the historically verifiable information in the Old Testament, in fact, is accurate. So, for instance, in Daniel, there is no way to verify that there actually was handwriting on the wall. But the story of the fall of Babylon in one night to the Persians, the way it is described in the Bible, in the book of Daniel, actually was also recounted on the face of a cliff, I think it's in Afghanistan, by the ancient Persians, which was discovered kind of by accident. It was discovered about 20 or 25 years ago. And it gave the essentially exact same story that the book of Daniel gives in the Old Testament. And all of the historically verifiable information from the time of David on has been verified archaeologically. So there is a very strong basis today to look at the Old Testament as genuinely a book that accurately recounts the interaction between God and the Israelites as a revelation of God, not only to them, but to all humanity.